currency Bitcoin saw its price pass $30,000 on Saturday for the first time, according to data compiled by the Bloomberg News Agency. The first decentralized cryptocurrency set a new record at 1313 GMT after breaking $20,000 on December 16th. Tesla Incorporated on Saturday reported better than expected 2020 vehicle deliveries, driven by a steady rise in electric vehicle adoption across the world's largest economies. The company delivered over 499,500 vehicles during 2020, which was above Wall Street estimates. Annual deliveries fell slightly shy of Tesla CEO Elon Musk's target of 500,000. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Zarif urged U.S. President Donald Trump on Saturday not to be trapped by an alleged Israeli plan to provoke war through attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq. He issued the warning on the anniversary of the U.S. killing of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani by a drone strike in Iraq. Washington blames Iran-backed militia for regular rocket attacks on U.S. facilities in Iraq, including near the U.S. embassy, but no known Iran-backed groups have claimed responsibility. Zarif tweeted on Saturday that new intelligence from Iraq indicates that Israeli agents are plotting attacks against Americans, putting an outgoing Trump in a bind with a fake act justifying war. The U.S. military flew two nuclear-capable B-52 bombers to the Middle East in a message of deterrence to Iran last week, but the bombers have since left the region. For more on these stories, please visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News, and here are some of the latest developments in the global coronavirus pandemic. An extension of an overnight curfew comes into effect in 15 departments of eastern and southeastern France on Saturday to combat a sharp rise in coronavirus infections. The government ordered the curfew in these regions to start at 6 p.m. Paris has, for now, been spared the additional restriction. Bangkok's nightlife will go quiet as a ban on bars, nightclubs, and restaurant alcohol sales goes into effect, among a list of restrictions aimed at curbing the kingdom's rising coronavirus toll. The capital of Thailand also announced that public schools will close for 2 weeks. More than a dozen virus checkpoints are set up across the city. Tokyo's governor has asked Japan's central government to declare a new state of emergency as the country battles a third wave of the coronavirus with record numbers of new cases. Japan imposed a first state of emergency in the spring. The measure allows local governors to call on businesses to close and to request people to stay at home. It carries no penalties for noncompliance, but the requests were widely observed in the spring. Norway has ordered mandatory tests for the coronavirus for anyone entering the country. The decision came after the discovery of 5 cases of the new variant of COVID-19 that has appeared in Britain. The Greek government announced a new extension as well until January 10th of its strict 2-month-old lockdown measures, ending an easing of the restrictions over the holiday period. Initially planned to end on January 7th, the strict measures will resume on Sunday until January 10th for reasons of prevention. That's according to a government spokesman. And Lebanon's hospitals are being overwhelmed by coronavirus cases, medics warned, as infection rates surge in the wake of end-of-year holidays. The National COVID-19 Task Force is expected to advise a 3-week lockdown, said Petra Corey, the task force head. The novel coronavirus has killed at least 1.8 million people since the outbreak emerged in China last December, according to Johns Hopkins University, and more than 84 million cases of coronavirus have been registered. The worst-hit countries in number of cases are the U.S., India, Brazil, Russia, and France. The hardest-hit nations when it comes to deaths, again, are the U.S., then followed by Brazil, India, Mexico, and Italy. Again, we invite you to visit our website for more stories. That's voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, and our moderator, Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome to the show. Here are the issues. After threatening to not sign a much-needed COVID relief bill, President Trump gives it his blessing but leaves Congress scrambling. And more countries approve vaccines as COVID numbers continue to surge. Plus, the UK and the EU finally reach a post-Brexit deal. We'll tell you what you need to know. And we'll get the latest on a Christmas Day suicide bombing that shook the U.S. city of Nashville. Tom and Jonathan, excited to talk to you both. Lots to cover. Let's start with this massive bipartisan COVID relief package that this week President Trump signed into law. But there were a few very confusing days leading up to it. The relief bill, it was negotiated with the president's representative, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. It was passed by Republicans in Congress who seemed to believe the president was on board with the bill. But then at the last minute, President Trump put the bill in jeopardy. He called it a disgrace. We were not certain he was going to even sign it, putting millions of people's unemployment benefits at risk. But then he did sign it. What changed his mind, Tom?
Well, I think what happened is he's down on vacation at his estate at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida. And he has a club there. He has a residence there. And when he's down there, it's easier for old friends and congressmen and senators, outsiders, and he also to get to him. And a lot of them were trying to persuade him one way or the other. I think he was vacillating. He wants to look like a populist here as he's heading out the door. He wanted to look like he was the big guy who was going to give the American people, long-suffering American people, more money. A lot of Republicans in the Senate, his Republicans, weren't all that thrilled about it. I think he played into the hands of the Democrats who said, oh, you want $2,000 more, Mr. President? We'll agree. We want that. Let's vote on it. So the democratically controlled House passed a $2,000 payment, and now it's tangled up in the internal warfare deliberations in the Senate, which is controlled by the Republicans.
I want to go back to this issue that you brought up, that the president was pushing for larger direct payments. This bill calls for $600 for eligible Americans. The president is insisting that he wants $2,000 for eligible Americans. Jonathan, I'm still a bit confused here, because if the president was so keen on these larger payments, why didn't he push for it during the negotiation process, not after the bill was passed?
That's a very, very good question. The president essentially was entirely absent from the negotiations. He appointed as his negotiator the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, and never really gave a number of how much money he wanted Americans to receive under the stimulus bill. Nancy Pelosi pressed Mnuchin several times during the negotiations to give him a number, and the $600 number was actually Mnuchin's number, not the president's, and he never really gave an indication of what the president wanted, because I don't think the president really said anything to Mnuchin. He was totally absent from these negotiations. And then, as you mentioned, he kind of swooped in after the bill had already been passed and said, oh, I want $2,000, which is what the Democrats have been asking for all along. So the basic answer is that he was absent from these talks until he decided to come in sort of as a deus ex machina at the very end to demand $2,000.
Basically, when he signed the package, the relief package, he said that essentially in return for signing it, Congress is going to look into election fraud. Again, there's been no evidence of mass election fraud that the president's been alleging. Also regulations on tech companies and then these larger checks. But a bill like that to couple all those issues together, none of that would actually get through the Democratic House. So did the president actually get anything from holding up this bill, Tom?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. And as Jonathan has pointed out, he's been pretty much missing in action since the election. He hasn't engaged in this issue, and he hasn't engaged much in the COVID-19 issue, which we'll come to later. I don't think he got anything other than to call his Senate leadership, the Republican Senate leadership, incompetent, and call the efforts of his Treasury Secretary, one of his most loyal cabinet members, pathetic, and made Stephen Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, look awfully bad by pulling out the rug from underneath him. I don't quite understand it, but I don't think the president got anything. I think you asked earlier, how did this happen? Well, I think a few members of Congress were able to persuade the president, look, Mr. President, we'll do all these other things you want on liability and other things, and we'll put that in another bill with $2,000, and we're going to make a good faith effort to deal with your objections there. And somehow I think the president was turned around, but that's not going to go anywhere either.
And Jonathan, it sounds like what Tom is saying, that the president threw his own party leadership under the bus. He threw his own Treasury Secretary under the bus with holding up this bill and also causing millions of people a lot of unneeded anxiety about whether or not they were going to be getting unemployment benefits from the government. Did he do this, do you think, to embarrass Republicans who aren't supporting his move to overturn the election? Or was this about getting Americans more cash? What do you see here?
Well, it's sort of a combination of both, I think. It's always difficult to sort of assess what Trump's motives are. But I think that he is very, very angry at Republicans for not supporting his claims of voter fraud and wanting to overturn the results of the election. I think what we're watching is that the president is basically conducting a scorched earth reaction to his own party. He's angry at them for not supporting him, and he doesn't really care whether he throws them under the bus or makes life difficult for them or embarrasses them or puts them in a very, very difficult position, which he has done right now.
I would say for sort of a president that follows the norms, this would look like President Trump self-sabotaging his own legacy, except that Donald Trump is the most dominant figure in the Republican Party. So this really puts Republicans in a tricky spot here, Tom, because on one hand, they need the president's support for their own elections. On the other hand, you see Republicans trying to stick up for the Republican ideas of fiscal responsibility and not giving out government monies. How is this playing out?
I just don't think it's playing well for Republicans these days. You're right. I think the Republicans in Congress would like to go back to what I might call the Republican Party of old, or days of yore, where they talked about fiscal responsibility. They didn't talk about it at all in the last couple of years when big spending legislation favored by the president was passed by them, and they had an enormous deficit. But now, with the Democratic president coming in, they want to talk more about fiscal responsibility. On the other hand, it should be noted that people are hurting and people need this money. And so I think the cries of certain Republican senators who say this is terribly irresponsible, that falls on deaf ears in a situation where you have tens of millions of Americans out of work, facing eviction notices early in the year. And so I don't think this is working well for Republicans, and I don't think it's working well for the president. I don't think he's getting the political bounce. On the other hand, it's very clear that the president has told some aides, you know, I can destroy a senator's reelection prospects with a single tweet. There's a little hyperbole there, but not a whole lot.
Right. We have seen President Trump, Republicans who have gone up against him, they lose their own elections. He does still have a lot of power. Even so, we are seeing Senate Republicans, at least the leadership, not very interested in even setting up a vote for the $2,000 checks. The other thing that's coming out of Congress this week is the House already voted to override the president's veto on the national defense bill. This is the first time Congress has ever voted to override a presidential veto. The Senate looks like it's going to do the same as of this taping. How did we get to this point, Jonathan?
What's interesting about this is that Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont who caucuses with the Democrats, is basically saying that unless Mitch McConnell agrees to have a standalone vote on the $2,000 checks to the Americans, Sanders is going to block any vote in the Senate to overturn the president's veto. So he's exercising his senatorial power to try to bring this $2,000 vote to the floor. McConnell has decided to create his own bill, which would include the $2,000 checks, but also two of the things that the president wants, which is some sort of law limiting the liability of making social media companies more responsible for the content on their sites, and also to look into election fraud. So he's proposing a commission to look into election fraud and some sort of action on social media companies.
As I said before, that there's very little chance that would pass the Democratic
exactly.
left.
That is
sort of dead on arrival. I want to continue to focus on the Senate for a minute because there's an important election happening right now in Georgia. Early voting has already begun. Two Senate seats are going to be decided. Tom, explain how important this election is, not only for who controls the Senate, but for what Joe Biden can do as president.
Bottom line at the moment is the Republicans hold a very narrow edge in the Senate. If the Democrats somehow win both these Senate seats in Georgia, the Senate will be 50-50, a tie. And under the rules of the Senate, a 50-50 tie means the vice president-elect, Senator Kamala Harris, will break a tie in favor of the Democrats. But it also means that the Democrats will take over control of the Senate. So it's critical for Republican interests that Republicans hang on to at least one of these seats. And so the bottom line is, there's a big difference between the Senate being controlled by Republicans, many of whom are not going to like many of what President-elect Biden's policies are, and the Senate being controlled by Democrats, even if it's evenly split 50-50. So the stakes are enormous, and the president, he is going down to campaign right before the election, but he seems somewhat ambivalent and indifferent. But the stakes of these two elections are critical for both the Democrats and the Republicans and for the new president.
The Republican candidates are very well aware that they do need President Trump's support. They both actually came out in support of the $2,000 check because they want to side with President Trump. They needed the support from his base. Jonathan, it's a bit of a pickle, though, because President Trump, as Tom mentioned, he's going down to rally for these two senators. But President Trump has also been telling anyone who will listen that elections in this country are rigged. So he's both telling people down there to vote, but also in some ways that their vote won't count.
What I find really interesting here is the fact that something that you mentioned, Shana, and that is the support that the two Republican incumbent senators in Georgia have given to the $2,000 checks. This is my own view, but I would think that given the state of the country right now, the fact that the pandemic is out of control, that people are hurting economically, the economy is in bad shape, there would be more than just the two senators from Georgia who would support the $2,000 check. I think that if this were put to a standalone vote, there would be enough Republicans to vote for the $2,000 check that the measure would pass in the Senate. And it's only the Republican leadership, the one of McConnell and those who have suddenly discovered fiscal responsibility after 4 years of ignoring it. They are the only ones who are standing against this, and I think that they would be defeated.
I'm sure if McConnell was on this conversation, on this call, he would push back and say he's always been fiscally responsible, so we're going to have to go with that. I want to take a break here, and when we come back, we're going to talk about President-elect Biden's transition, complaints that the outgoing administration, the Trump administration, is not cooperating with them, and we'll also get the latest on the distribution of vaccines here in the U.S. We'll be right back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, and our moderator, Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back to the show. Let's go to this topic. This coming Wednesday, it's an important date. It's the day Congress is set to certify the election results. By all appearances, they're going to declare that Joe Biden is the winner of the presidential election. We still don't know if and when President Trump will concede. He certainly hasn't conceded yet. He still insists that he won the election without any evidence. That refusal to concede seems to be bleeding into the transition and what information Joe Biden, the president-elect, is or isn't getting. At least that's what the Biden team has been alleging, that the Trump administration is not cooperating with them. What specifically are they upset about, Tom?
Well, they're specifically upset about what they allege is a lack of cooperation at the Pentagon and the Office of Management and Budget. And in the last few days, the president-elect himself has gone public saying this cooperation has not been forthcoming, and it smacks of irresponsibility. Whatever else it is or isn't, and of course the Republicans who control OMB, the Budget Office, and the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, say this is not true, but they don't do a very good job of convincing people by saying, well, we've had 400 meetings and we've given them 5,000 pages of this or that. There's apparently some classified information that the incoming Biden team feels they really need to know about. On the budget side, they feel like there's quite a bit of information about the distribution of the vaccine that they have not gotten very good information on. And
Jonathan, is that something, I want you to jump in here, because is that something unusual? Isn't there generally tension between incoming and outgoing administrations, or are you seeing something different this time around?
This is unprecedented. It's not only different, it's unprecedented. A lot of people have used the analogy that the handoff during the transition from one administration to the other is very much like a relay race. And if you know anything about relay races, as one runner passes a baton to his relay partner, that relay partner is running at full speed so that when his teammate hands off the baton to him or her, that person can grab the baton and is already running at full speed. So there's no loss of time in the handoff. And what the Biden administration says they are finding is that as they are getting prepared to take possession of the baton, in other words, the U.S. government, the Trump people are not even running at all. It's not as if they're trotting or walking slow. They're not there. So the handoff is basically happening very, very, very slowly. And as Tom mentioned, and as you have mentioned, in certain departments, there is obstruction. They're not cooperating at all. There's one other fact that is very important to note, and that is that what Biden said when he criticized the Trump administration for not being cooperative on the handoff is that certain parts of the Pentagon have been totally hollowed out. So there really isn't any baton to hand off. Certain departments are just empty. Their people have left. They haven't had any record of what they've been doing. So there's really nothing to hand off there. That's very, very disturbing.
We heard a lot of criticism coming from Biden and his team, including his incoming National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, about this. As Tom pointed out, officials from the Pentagon and the OMB are pushing back. They say they are cooperating. Certainly, there are a lot of challenges ahead on this issue. I want to talk about another big challenge in the U.S., and that is the distribution of vaccines. We're now about 9-10 months into this pandemic. The numbers keep rising. At this point, according to data collected by the New York Times, at least 1 in 17 people have contracted the virus in this country. Over 335,000 people have died. An incoming member of Congress died from COVID. His name is Luke Letlow. He's from Louisiana. He was 41 years old. He's the first U.S. Congress member to die from the virus, although, as we know, dozens of others have been infected. The numbers are surging, especially as we're in this holiday season where people are traveling. We do have another vaccine that's getting into a late stage of the clinical trial, so more vaccines on the horizon, which is good. But Tom, how is the vaccine rollout going here in the U.S. from what you're seeing?
They call it Operation Warp Speed. There's no warp about this. As recently as a month ago, senior members of the government, they all said, we are confident that there will be 20 million doses of this vaccine administered into the arms of Americans by the end of the year. As of the moment, it's about 2.5 million doses have been administered, which is about a 90% shortfall.
Let's unpack this, Jonathan, with what Tom was saying. You've got this Operation Warp Speed. The Trump administration has gotten credit for this mission to work with private companies to fast-track vaccines. I mean, two vaccines were ready for the market within 9 months, which is remarkable. Even Joe Biden praised the administration on that. But there's a difference between getting vaccines to market and sending them out to states and getting those vaccines into people's arms. And that's what Tom was talking about, that the U.S. is at a very slow pace to actually giving people shots. Administration officials are defending their job. They're saying, look, we did a lot here. We sent out these vaccines. It's up to the states to figure out who gets it. Is it that simple that the federal government sends it out and then washes their hands and it's up to the states to figure out who gets the shot?
In short, no. The answer is no. The problem here is that just like the president did with testing and with the supply of personal protective equipment, what they call PPE in short, the president and the administration has left everything up to the states. However, the administration has not provided any of the infrastructure or the money to help the states with its distribution. So, for example, the states have not been told how many doses of the vaccines they're going to get. They have not been told which vaccine they're going to get, which affects the storage of the vaccine. For example, one vaccine, I think the Pfizer vaccine, requires extremely low temperature just to store it. The other vaccine does not require that. The administration has not provided the infrastructure that the states need in order to carry out what the administration says they ought to be doing. The president tweeted out that the system here is that we produce the vaccine, the federal government, and then we send it out to the states, and it's now up to the states to distribute this vaccine.
There does appear to be some money in this new relief package for states to help for distributing vaccines, but health experts are saying it's a little too late for that when states are struggling right now. Local health agencies have this massive task and not enough funding. Biden is promising to take a more aggressive approach. We'll see how they tackle this issue. This is going to be a big problem the next couple of months, especially as COVID numbers surge. I want to move to another topic. We have a couple minutes left. This was a big week for international news. The UK and the EU approved a post-Brexit deal between the two of them. It took 10 months to negotiate. It lays down the future relationship between the UK and the Europeans. From a U.S. perspective, Tom, this is good news for Biden because it means he comes into office and he doesn't have to play peacemaker between allies.
Exactly right. This is kind of like the development of a vaccine in terms of the timeline here. This Brexit deal between the United Kingdom and the European Union was put together in 9 months. That's remarkably swift, and it looks like a pretty respectable compromise. But
I'm sorry, did you just say the word swift when it comes to Brexit? It's not a word I usually hear when it comes to Brexit,
well,
you
except,
are, at least
except,
for this deal.
Well, the trade agreement was negotiated in 9 months,
yes.
Which is faster than the typical trade arrangement, and at least it's a compromise that seems to resolve certain of the more difficult issues, like whether you treat Ireland as a so-called hard border or other things. But the bottom line is, this is a problem that's been resolved at the moment, and that's not going to be at the top of the new president's list. He's going to have to broker a lot of things, but he's not going to have to worry about what's going to happen with the Brexit deal, because now there is one.
Right, that is true. Jonathan, I want to go to you for this last topic. We have a couple of minutes here. The suicide bombing Christmas Day in the U.S. city of Nashville. Law enforcement officials say a 63-year-old man, they've identified him as Anthony Warner, blew himself up with his motorhome in the city's downtown, damaging dozens of buildings, causing really just a ton of damage in the heart of the city. No one else was killed. We are learning now that a year ago, his girlfriend warned police that he was building explosives in his RV. What else do we know about this man, and do we yet know what his motive was?
We don't know a lot about this man. The FBI and other authorities are still looking into this. But the fact that he placed his RV in front of a AT&T building has led some authorities to speculate, and I emphasize the word speculate, that Mr. Warner may have been influenced by some conspiracy theories that say that the 5G networks, the new networks that telecommunications companies are using, somehow spreads COVID and other crazy ideas. So one of the theories is that he may have placed this car bomb or the truck bomb or RV bomb in front of AT&T to underscore embrace of this theory. But right now, it's not possible to know what the motive was.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the word is speculative. We still don't know what the motivation was.
Yeah.
Or what was behind this bomb that he detonated and killed himself. And thankfully, nobody else was killed in this explosion. Let's leave it here. That's all the time we have. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is my current affairs colleague, Rick Pantaleo, author of VOA's Science in a Minute and host of the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. On this edition of the program, Amy Webb, author, futurist, and founder of Future Today Institute and futurist Mark Palatucci. Join us for our annual conversation about the future of technology and its implications for business, society, and politics. The Future Today Institute is a leading future forecasting firm now in its second decade. Founded by Amy Webb in 2006, the Future Today Institute focuses on how emerging technology and science will disrupt business, transform the workforce, and ignite geopolitical change. Speaking of disruption, the COVID-19 pandemic was a major disruptor in 2020. So we will ask Amy and Mark how the pandemic affected the workplace, especially the use of remote meeting platforms, and if some of these changes may forever alter the nature of work, whether in the public or private sector. We will also discuss the pandemic's disproportionate impact on and implications for the travel and leisure industry. Amy Webb is the author of several books, including her latest, The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. The book warns of the role nine of the world's biggest tech companies are playing in the development of artificial intelligence and how it could affect all of humankind. Today, Amy and Mark talk about artificial intelligence, technology trends that shaped 2020, and what we can expect in 2021 and beyond. Amy and Mark join us via Microsoft Teams, another indication that we are not yet out of the woods as we all continue to social distance due to the coronavirus pandemic. Amy and Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And as always, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, in-house science, technology, and health guru, Rick Pantaleo.
Good to be here.
Amy, general question first. Can you give us an overview of this past year's Emerging Trends Report?
Sure. Every year we put together a compendium of all of the different longer-term trends that we are investigating and following. They tend to fall into some categories. In the past year, we've particularly paid interest to emerging science and tech that has to do with healthcare, communications. So those would be things like augmented reality and diminished reality in the healthcare space. This would be using personal data and trying to understand or make sense of your personal health needs. Of course, artificial intelligence, autonomous vehicles, there's been a lot. Some new things that we've really had on our radar have to do with collaborative robots. So these are robots capable of working with each other, something that we call the U of things. So this is like the Internet of Things, except the things are on your body, so things that you wear, and a host of other technologies that cross over into more sort of science. So this would be nanobots, programmable matter, synthetic biology, things like that.
Well, Amy, let me follow up with something a bit more pedestrian. COVID-19 was a major event and still is with us in 2021. But in 2020, COVID-19 transformed the way we work. For example, we're on this remote platform on Teams, there's Zoom. I wanted to get an idea from you how you think this pandemic has indeed transformed the workplace, how people work generally, and to what extent it may extend even beyond the pandemic once the vaccine takes effect and people are immunized. To what extent will our manners of work be part of the architecture of everyday life?
One of the most interesting stories I heard from 2020 has to do with one of the world's largest companies, and it's based in Japan. That company is Fujitsu. What's interesting about Fujitsu is it has, I think, 130 employees. It's one of the world's best companies, one of the world's most active companies in telecommunications and infrastructure and IT. It's also a Japanese company. And a lot of Japan went back to work pretty soon after the pandemic hit. And Fujitsu created a new policy, which was that employees can work from home over the long term. Now, whether or not this is a permanent policy, we'll have to wait and see. But a Japanese company, which operates very traditionally, it's very against the culture to have people working not in an office. For a company like that, it was a really big change. That didn't just mean a cultural shift. It also required a lot of organizational changes and technological changes. And for me, this was one of the biggest signals coming out of this entire thing. We're really seeing companies of all shapes and sizes changing how they operate to allow for more flexibility and to allow workers to be in places that are the most convenient for them and to put a lot of more of their systems online. One of the, I think, tensions created by the virus is that a lot of companies really weren't positioned to go all virtual and they weren't really making use of the cloud. So that's another huge shift that we saw.
Let me now turn to my colleague, Rick, for some questions.
I have a question about how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected your business and the forecasts that have been made and will be made. Has it affected, for example, the algorithms that your company uses to make its projections?
We've been quite busy. I think the pandemic has brought to the forefront kind of all the uncertainties and risks that are out there that are just simply unforeseen by a lot of the clients that we work with. And so while those risks are ever present, and even the risk of something like a pandemic has been present for quite some time now. And if you look back to previously to last year, there were a lot of people who did sort of, I wouldn't say predict, but certainly forecasted something like this pandemic coming upon them. People don't, and companies don't really necessarily recognize the true gravity and reality of such a situation until it hits us all so hard as coronavirus has.
And speaking of impacts, what has the impact of the contentious 2020 presidential and congressional elections had on your trends?
Policy uncertainty is always present. I think over the past 4 years, there's been an unprecedented amount of uncertainty, in part because we're sort of in this new situation where we've got a lot of vitriol on Capitol Hill, people coming from non-traditional positions entering the public space, and quite frankly, a change in direction from the previous administration. The United States does not have a Department of the Future. We used to have something called the Office of Technology Assessment, which was charged with doing some longer term thinking that was divorced from politics. We don't have that anymore. It got defunded in the 90s. And so, unfortunately, a lot of the conversations and thinking and policy around technology and science become politicized. And that was very true in the past 4 years. So, looking ahead, anybody in any area of business or anybody working in any part of any government, whether it's your local village government or your national government, you have to really look at the Venn diagram of science, technology, and politics because they are inextricably tied. My assumption is that over the next couple of years, it's going to take us a little bit of time to find a new normal because the policies that we're very likely looking at from the United States going into the next few years are going to be very different from the ones that we recently had. And the easiest example of that is probably climate. Over the past 4 years, we've walked away from the Paris Climate Accord and really drastically changed our national viewpoints on various issues related to climate. That has a trickle-down effect to companies that have to make decisions about their supply chains. I know this stuff is kind of boring, but it has a direct impact on things like R&D and investment. Companies have to do long-term planning of their own. And when we have a lot of uncertainty at our highest levels of government, that makes their work very challenging. I think we're now headed into a different direction, arguably one that's better for the longer term, but the policy uncertainty will not go away. It's going to take us a few years to right the ship.
Well, from policy questions to artificial intelligence, and maybe Mark Palatucci wants to take this, I would like for you to give us a sense of the potential for good that AI presents in 2021 and beyond, and what are maybe some of the drawbacks?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I think has shifted somewhat last year was AI runs on data. Data is the fuel that really powers the engine of AI. And a lot of the data is coming from, you know, individual citizens and being collected en masse. And in the past, there has been an understandable reticence to necessarily give up data when we have the choice. We don't necessarily want to give out this information that can be quite personal at times. But interestingly, when the pandemic hit, it actually allowed for the rollback of a lot of potential protections for personal data. Because if you take something like contact tracing, where data about where you have been, who you've been near, and that's data that is usually transmitted via a personal device like a smartphone, that can be quite intimate personal data. However, if it's being collected and used with the intent of keeping a city or a country safe, then the government has a much easier time explaining to the public and justifying their actions in collecting that data. So as we've seen across a number of different kind of realms and fields, COVID has acted as an accelerant. So not necessarily introducing altogether new elements to our society, but speeding up certain elements. And one of those elements has been the facility with which companies and devices can collect our data and then what that data can be used for. And ultimately, that makes AI that much more powerful in all of its many manifestations.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guests are Amy Webb and Mark Palatucci of the Future Today Institute, a leading future forecasting firm. Amy is the Institute's founder and CEO, and Mark is a futurist with the company. And this is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website at voanews.com/PCUSA and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. We hope you'll also get in touch with us through either Facebook or Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or by sending us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. And now back to our Press Conference USA with Amy Webb and Mark Palatucci of the Future Today Institute. And let me turn to my colleague, Rick Pantaleo, for another question.
Amy, Mark, I've been going through some of your recent newsletters and looking at some of the emerging trends. And the one thing that comes to mind first is something that you've indicated, diminished reality. We're looking at DR versus AR versus VR. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. So this, you know, may be second nature to many of your listeners, but it's important to understand the very sort of fundamental differences between AR and VR. So AR being augmented reality, you're introducing new virtual elements to your environment, whereas VR is fully immersive, right? So that you're being sort of virtually transported from your environment to one that is entirely different, that's either been virtually generated or is emulating some sort of environment that is remote or foreign to you. When we talk about AR, however, there's a little bit almost of a bias in that term, because when we say augmented, we think of additive elements. If I'm looking through a set of smart eyewear, for example, augmented reality might introduce a data overlay to the city or the people that I'm looking at, or even introduce sort of synthetically generated characters or elements to my field of view. When we talk about the sort of subfield within AR of diminished reality, we're actually talking about sort of muting or suppressing features and elements of our surroundings rather than adding to them. So one pretty obvious example that I'm sure a lot of your listeners can relate to would be noise-canceling headphones, right? That's kind of muting what might be sort of distracting or unwanted noise in our sort of field of hearing around us. But when we extend that concept into the field of vision as well, it becomes quite interesting. Out of a crowd of people, be able to focus in on one person in the crowd using diminished reality to sort of blur out the view of all of those other people. And while this might be useful in making an individual's day-to-day life a little bit more comfortable, right? You don't have to look at or listen to those things you don't want to. There's also applications in, for example, the medical field. Studies have been conducted with patients who are on the autism spectrum for whom certain visual cues or audio stimuli can be quite disruptive and distracting. And so diminished reality has been used to sort of subdue those potentially triggering elements for folks who are on the autism spectrum and has allowed them to sort of focus and interact in a way that's more comfortable. So a very fascinating subfield of augmented reality, which is DR.
Another one of the emerging trends involves consumer behavior. And I know this past year, especially with the pandemic, consumer behavior has definitely shifted. There's more online purchasing done over the past year than ever before, with the brick and mortar stores sort of taking a back seat. What are your thoughts about what's going to be happening as far as consumer behaving? And will new technologies such as AI help us better understand consumer actions?
You know, the consumer tensions that were present in the past few years have shifted in response to not being able to be out in the world as we normally would. I think that combined with, in many parts of the world, slowdown in the local economy has led to pretty sizable shifts in consumer behavior. But that being said, this is an area where we've seen technology step in and provide some interesting solutions to resolve some of those tensions. So areas that we've seen take off have to do with delivery. In the state of Pennsylvania, for example, some local ordinances just cleared the way to allow land-based drones to make deliveries, which probably would not have happened had it not have been for COVID. Likewise, we're seeing an acceleration of air-based deliveries, or at least more pilots to allow that technology to be used, which again, we probably would not have seen otherwise. There are pretty big changes happening in the biotech sector related to fast-tracking clinical trials related to the vaccine, and a lot of consumer transactions that have to do with touchless payments. Somewhat interestingly, in the same year that many cities rolled back their ordinances on whether or not you can use cash, those kind of became a thing in 2019 and 2020 around the world. A lot of communities, a lot of stores no longer accepted cash. Everybody decided that that was a hardship for many people. And so those got reversed and then they got reversed again because touchless, contactless payments are safer in the age of COVID. And what that did was accelerate a move to digital terminals and things like that. So broadly speaking, the way that we receive goods, the way that we pay for goods, and the way that we shop for those things online versus in stores will probably stick with us well after the pandemic has subsided.
Amy or Mark, I have a two-part question. One, you talk about in your emerging trends that technology has been key to helping feed a growing world population and that big tech has taken a greater interest in farming. Can you explain?
So I can think of a couple examples where technology has sort of advanced progress on making the most of the global food supply. So one of them would be in vertical farming. So moving these kind of vast plots of land that, you know, are sort of located throughout the country and the world that are used to farm naturally, organically, and sort of transitioning that whole process into an indoor, more highly controlled environment. Now, this is useful in and successful in a couple of ways, but one of the most important is that if you're a farmer who's been used to sort of farming on the open land and is now going to be able to produce food indoors, you can now control that climate and all of the various stimuli and nutrients that your crops are receiving. So you're no longer kind of responding to the whims of the weather, the seasons, and other risks that can present for farmers in kind of the open natural world, right? So it allows for a lot more control. Amy and I have also worked with clients who have either partners in farming or that's part of their supply chain. And a big movement right now is towards the smart farm. So being able to track everything from livestock to vegetables, plant-based crops, track their progress, and even use AI to determine what might be most beneficial course of action to help them grow into the sort of product that that farmer might need.
Amy, you also talk about in your Tech Trends report that, quote, everyone alive today is being scored, unquote, and we're not talking just about China. I wanted you to explain that. What is scoring, and why should we potentially be worried about that?
You know, in order for our automated systems to work, they have to quantify us in some way. And there's nothing nefarious at play here. It's just the way that our systems were built to work. The challenge is that as our automated systems evolve, they require more and more of our data. And that means that we're being quantified in ever new ways. And most people aren't aware when that's happening. Most of the time, this is invisible. You don't know that it's happening until there's a problem. And we've seen over the past 12 months, lots of problems that have to do with police misidentifying somebody because of their skin color. There have been plenty of instances of algorithmic scoring misidentifying a person of color as a criminal when in actuality they were not. We've seen people receive different prices for things like toilet paper when shopping online, because a third party has correlated their data, assigned a score, and determined that they're likely to pay a higher price. In a lot of countries around the world, including in the United States, there are laws against charging different people different prices based on their ethnicity or their skin color or gender. Those laws don't apply in the same way in the digital realm. When we talk about algorithmic scoring, we tend to think of China, and it's useful to know that, you know, in some way, we're all being watched, we're all being surveilled, and we are all being scored all the time. In some ways, China is just more transparent about it. Now, I will also say that in the past few months, it's come to light that China is using aggressive scoring techniques, specifically targeting the Uyghur population for the purpose of detaining them or infringing on their basic human rights. So this is something that we as an organization are certainly paying attention to going into 2021, and we'll be paying attention throughout the year. But, you know, everyday people, this is really an important thing for you to be paying attention to as well.
And Carol, you mentioned earlier, what are the differences between AI being used for good and AI potentially being used for harm? And you mentioned that in many of its forms, AI is a system by which to make decisions. And so if I, as an individual, have given up my data or my data has been taken from me, and now this AI system, wherever it may be, is making a decision for me, it doesn't necessarily make it that decision on my behalf. And I think that's the difference between, or one of these instances where we can see AI for good versus AI that might be a little bit more harmful or detrimental. If the AI is making a choice to charge me more for a product because they know my willingness to pay might be higher, well, that doesn't feel like a decision being made on my behalf, but it's being made for me. So I think transparency is quite important when we talk about AI and data governance. And also, as Amy mentioned, just a vigilance from the individual to know that anytime they're working with a system, if AI is involved, there may be decisions being made behind the scenes, and making sure that you're sort of as aware of those as possible.
Amy and Mark, I wonder if you could tell us about the 2021 speculative travel calendar that your company recently released. And in conjunction with that, to what extent do you think that the travel and leisure industry can recover from the deleterious impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, whether it's air travel, hotels, cruise ships, and of course, restaurants and so forth?
I'm happy to take the piece about what the industry can do to recover. Mark, why don't you describe the genesis of the calendar and what it is, and people really love it. So maybe you can go into that.
Absolutely. So at year end, every year, we like to produce either a small asset or a product, something that really embodies our mentality in strategic foresight, but also something that we can have a little bit of fun with, something that we can share with our followers, our fans, our network clients as well. This past year, we decided to play off of the pandemic in a certain way. Now, the pandemic is a very serious topic, but it had some potential repercussions, especially around travel, that we wanted to kind of have a tongue-in-cheek take on. So what we created was a calendar kind of in the style of old-timey travel posters that you might see at a travel agency. But rather than the destinations being these idyllic scenes trying to lure people to travel there, they were more these absurd or potentially dystopian scenes of how technology might affect some of these different locales. So one of my favorites is the calendar actually leads off with the destination of nowhere. And this is a playoff of what some of these travel companies have actually done, at least in the short term, when the pandemic really shut down travel, or at least leisure travel. They began offering flights essentially to nowhere. So these are round trip flights. It's just one flight round trip, right? So you take off and land in the same airport. And these provided a little bit of like a scenic tour potentially of the, you know, landmarks rather surrounding the airport and the area. But it was kind of this funny small fix that some of these airlines tried to implement. And it certainly is not a long-term solution to the massive loss of business that they've had.
The travel calendar, it's a, what's called a visual scenario where we speculate, but use data and evidence to try to think about next order impacts and what might happen. But in reality, the travel industry is facing a reckoning. And again, I think that there are analogies to what's happening in travel to other industries. There are always problems plaguing industries and companies because they do not invest in long-term planning. So there were already endemic issues facing the airlines with regard to data, data governance, how people were traveling, what they were willing to pay for, climate change, you know, things like that. And certainly when it comes to rail travel, long distance rail, short distance high speed rail is popular in lots of places around the world. It has been attempted in fits and starts here in the United States. But again, these are long-term infrastructure projects, and there's not a lot of appetite to do that type of long-term investment or planning. And it's important to remember that in this exact same year, in New York City, where Mark and I live and work, the MTA shut down for maintenance after, I think, 100 years. And it's been a real challenge, a real headache. So these are all very good reminders that even after the pandemic, it's hard to think of this now, but you know, people are going to want to travel. Business will pick back up. People will continue to go places. But the business models as they existed before were a little broken. And this is a really good opportunity to go back to the whiteboard and think through how improvements can be made that serve the greater good over the longer term.
Amy, as we close, I would like to ask a quick question about the internet, but it has to do with social media. We've talked about this so many times on the program. But are you any more optimistic about, let's say, Facebook or any of the other platforms, Twitter, with respect to keeping off bad actors or fake accounts? Because we are seeing, you know, a proliferation of hate speech, of outright disinformation. We saw that during the campaign, our campaign, other election campaigns across the world. And I'm just concerned that this is going to be with us for some time. Do you see any actions on the part of these companies to in any way combat this very dangerous trend?
Let me say this. There's the action that the company is taking at a corporate level, and then there are the people who work within the companies. These are enormous publicly traded companies that have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders, and everybody now knows that salacious, incendiary content drives more traffic, which means more eyeballs, which means more money. Now, that being said, there are a number of federal actions and state level actions that all of these companies are facing right now. And I happen to know several teams and several people who work in places like Facebook who are working very, very hard to try to combat these exact problems. The challenge here is that this is not an easy fix. I'm heartened by the individual people that I know at Facebook and at Google who are working really hard on some of these problems. There's like systems level issues though. So it can't just be individual people or teams of people. Companies have to be willing to make changes. So I don't think the problem just has to do with the technology or the transmission of information. We have a civility problem. And I think we also have a problem. I mean, some of this is targeted national security issues and targeted information or society hacking by other nations. Some of this is just people being really mean to each other. So one thing we could do as we go into this new year is, you know, make a decision that we don't want to do that anymore. It doesn't serve our interests over the longer term.
Social media platforms tend to amplify this type of incivility and disinformation. So we'll just have to all be very vigilant, make sure we don't fall for false information and be able to distinguish between that which is true and that which is false. But I'm afraid that is just about all the time we have on this edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank our special guests on this annual Futures edition of the program, kicking off 2021, Amy Webb. She's author, futurist, and founder of Future Today Institute, and Mark Palatucci, who is a futurist with the company. Press Conference USA was produced in Washington, and joining me on the program was my colleague and our in-house science guru, Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Please join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman, and here